ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The conclave to elect the next pope is officially underway. We'll give you the latest from the Vatican.
It's Wednesday, May 7th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, a school district in Maine figures out how to offer mental health services after federal funding cuts.
What went through my head was having a hard time understanding why anyone would cut mental health supports for kids.
Also, scientists calculate that more than 99% of the deep sea floor remains a mystery.
There's still a need for a systematic global approach to deep ocean exploration.
And some U.S. veterans are trying to get clinical trials going for a drug that could help treat PTSD.
Those stories and more after the summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The armed hostilities between India and Pakistan are escalating as India's army accused their Pakistani counterparts of killing more than a dozen civilians. NPR's Omkar Khandakar reports.
Indian officials tell NPR that Pakistani artillery fire damaged a Sikh temple and injured more than 40 civilians in Indian-administered region of Jammu and Kashmir. The artillery barrage came after Indian missiles struck multiple locations in Pakistan. Long-simmering tensions between India and Pakistan have spiked since a group of gunmen killed 26 people in Indian-administered Kashmir last month. India blames Pakistan-based militant groups for the attack and has said its missiles last night targeted the militants' training camps. Pakistan says India's strike mostly killed civilians, including women and children. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
There are a lot of new tariffs in effect or about to come online. Some of that cost is being eaten by exporters in other countries. But NPR's Emily Fang reports a lot of the cost is being borne by Americans.
NPR asked people in the U.S. to share their shopping bills to see how the tariffs were hitting them. And they sent in dozens of receipts. One of the people who responded is Sandy Alonzo. She ordered a replacement for her old wheelchair. Only China makes it. By the time it arrived in Tampa, she was facing a 145% tariff. She ended up paying nearly $6,000, $3,500 in tariffs alone.
I'm just sitting here going, wow, I can't believe I've just paid this much for this chair.
Small businesses also sent in screenshots of new price hikes they've had to pass on to customers. They say sharing tariff data is a choice and sometimes a political one. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
A new survey shows two-thirds of Americans who don't own a home say they are priced out of the market. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports the research also finds fewer people plan to buy a home in the near future.
A Gallup survey finds just over half of non-homeowners do say they plan to buy in the next 5 to 10 years, but that's a major drop from a decade ago. Renters say the biggest reason by far is cost, including the down payment. Housing experts say spiking rents have made it harder to save up for that. Plus, mortgage rates and median home prices remain high. Gallup does find fewer people expect home prices to rise in their area over the next year, but an overwhelming majority still say it's a bad time to buy a house. That negative shift happened in 2022 after decades when people in the United States were mostly positive about home buying. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks ended a mostly choppy trading day on Wall Street, closing modestly higher. All three of the major indexes up on a day the Federal Reserve took no action on interest rates. The Dow rose 284 points. The Nasdaq was up 48 points. The S&P gained 24 points. This is NPR. Utah made national headlines for becoming the first state to ban fluoride in public water systems earlier this year. That law goes into effect today. And Utah seems to have set the stage for other states to follow. Sage Miller with member station KUER in Salt Lake City reports.
Under the law, which is now in effect, Utah cities are no longer allowed to add fluoride to drinking water. The mineral is known for preventing cavities, but lawmakers in Utah's Republican supermajority argued there are more risks associated with fluoride than benefits. And removing fluoride is something that Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, has championed. Since Utah approved its ban, six other states have proposed doing the same. For NPR News, I'm Sage Miller in Salt Lake City.
Law enforcement and judges in a number of states who have had to deal with repeat offenders when it comes to speeding violations may have a new tool in their arsenal. It's a device that can actually be installed to prevent a vehicle from accelerating far past the speed limit. Virginia has become the first state to approve the tool for reckless drivers. Similar measures are awaiting governor's signatures in Washington State and Georgia. Legislation was inspired by a Seattle crash where a teen traveling at 112 miles an hour killed a woman and three children when he slammed into their minivan. He's serving a more than 17-year sentence, though will be required to use the device once he is freed on probation. Crude oil futures prices lost ground today as investors pricing a buildup in gasoline inventories. Oil down more than a dollar a barrel to settle at $58.07 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Rome on the edge of St. Peter's Square, where this evening, black smoke emerged from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel. The conclave to elect the next pope is officially underway, and no surprise, the College of Cardinals did not reach a two-thirds majority on its very first ballot. The first day of the conclave is a day filled with ceremony. It began with morning mass at St. Peter's Basilica. Then this afternoon, the 133 voting cardinals processed together through the Vatican, past the Swiss guards, and into the Sistine Chapel under its famous frescoes painted by Michelangelo. Walking two by two in their scarlet choir dress, the cardinals chanted the Litany of the Saints. A formal appeal for guidance and blessings from the major figures of the Catholic Church. They bowed before the altar, looking at Michelangelo's fresco of the Last Judgment, where the blessed are ascending to heaven and the damned are being herded to hell. They took their seats at tables draped in burgundy, set up lengthwise down the sides of the chapel, where they could look up at the illustrations of the creation story. Then they each swore a solemn oath.
Et ego Robertus Franciscus Cardinalis Prevost.
And finally,
extra omnes.
The master of liturgical ceremonies proclaimed extra omnes, the formal order delivered in Latin, everyone out. From that point forward, all we on the outside can do is look at the chapel's chimney and wait for smoke. And that is exactly what NPR's religion correspondent Jason DeRose has been doing with me all day here on the edge of the square. Jason, they kind of gave us a scare tonight.
That's right, Scott. More than 3 hours behind closed doors before the black smoke.
Beyond that wait, what were your first impressions of today's first day of the conclave?
Well, that this is a religious ceremony, not just an election. I think we often get caught up in the politics of a papal election, what issues and candidates are most prominent. But I'm struck by how the day has been an extended liturgy, beginning with a mass this morning, later in the day a procession into the Sistine Chapel, and the singing of the hymn, Veni Creator Spiritus, to pray for guidance from the Holy Spirit.
That is all true. And yet there has been so much debate and discussion over these past few days. There has been some political posturing. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Scott, the cardinals in the days leading up to the conclave have been talking about the world, how wars and conflicts from Gaza to Ukraine to Sudan affect human lives, how technology is changing people's relationship to each other and to the church, how climate change is affecting huge swaths of the church in Asia and Africa and South America. I would say all of those are ways in which Pope Francis is influencing this conclave from beyond the grave. You know, he appointed large numbers of cardinals from places in conflict, places affected by climate change. And having those cardinals from those places in that room changes the conversation.
Yeah, and there's also been a lot of focus on not just the church in the world, but also discussions of the world of the church.
That's right. The church is a human institution too, and one that makes mistakes and is often self-referential. Among the topics cardinals discussed in the days leading up to the conclave, church finances, which are not in good shape, the ongoing fallout of clergy sexual abuse, which they've still not been able to effectively get a handle on, despite decades of trying. Also, how the church talks about doctrine. I want to read you a quote from the sermon from this morning's Mass given by Cardinal Giovanni Battista Re, Dean of the College of Cardinals. Quote, "The unity of the church is willed by Christ, a unity that does not mean uniformity, but a firm and profound communion in diversity." And I think that's interesting that he's stressing unity, not uniformity, and community in diversity, because there's been a lot of the use of this word unity as a way to criticize people who want discussion, who want openness to different, more diverse ways of being the church in the world.
This is the point where the conclave gets very hard to report on, because by definition, the cardinals are locked away. We have no idea what's happening at this point forward. What generally, though, from the reporting we've gathered, from what we've observed, what generally do we have a sense of when it comes to what they're considering?
Well, I think it's fair to say one of the big questions before them is whether they want to continue the reforms that Pope Francis began. Those were popular with many progressives, but unpopular with conservatives. Or do the cardinals want to go in another direction, perhaps a more conservative one, perhaps in the vein of Benedict XVI? Or is there a middle path, keeping on the reform track, but maybe moving more slowly than Francis did? But again, Scott, those are political considerations. And as I said earlier, the cardinals also view this as a profoundly religious, spiritual time. They believe the Holy Spirit is helping them discern God's will. And as many cardinals have said over the last several weeks, they're electing the successor to St. Peter, not the successor to Pope Francis.
The big question is how long this will last. How should we think about that question? How much should we read into it?
Well, most recent conclaves have been fairly short, between 1 and 3 days. So I'd expect something in that vicinity. Starting tomorrow, there'll be 2 morning votes and 2 afternoon votes until someone gets a 2/3 supermajority. The thought is that nobody wants a long conclave because it could signal disunity or internal conflicts, and I am not expecting a reenactment of the 13th century papal election that lasted almost 3 years.
That is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose with me here in Rome. We'll be back again tomorrow. Jason, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration has announced that it will cut $1 billion from a program that sent federal money to schools for mental health care. Passed in 2022, the bipartisan Safer Communities Act was especially valuable for students in rural areas where access to mental health services is limited. NPR's Janaki Mehta was in Maine one day before news of the cuts came.
Wednesday night last week, when the Trump administration announced the school mental health cuts, I was on the road home from talking to students and counselors in Skowhegan, Maine. It's an area where schools have licensed counselors because of the Safer Communities Act. It's a rural district 1.5 hours north of Portland that serves around 2,500 students.
How you doing?
Good. That's where we met Riley, a fifth grader at Millstream Elementary.
What you got there?
Miss Jordan has this basket of fidgets for people who like to fidget with things.
With a purple squishy fidget toy in hand, she sat down with me in her counselor Jordan Shigali's office.
It actually kind of helps me concentrate because sometimes when I'm in school, I kind of like zone out and I'm just like.
Riley's an energetic, moon-faced fifth grader with her hair pulled back in a braid. We're only using her first name because she's a minor and because of student privacy laws. Riley and more than 40 other students see Jordan Shigali every week in a cozy office where the walls are lined with stacks of toys, puzzles, and artwork. Riley has been in counseling for more than 2 years now, and she says it's helped manage her anger.
Miss Jordan taught me to talk through it instead of getting physical, so.
I feel like with Riley, she has found her voice.
That's Jordan Shigali, or Miss Jordan, as the students call her.
And feeling comfortable, like having difficult conversations, communicating her needs.
Miss Jordan is one of three licensed clinical professional counselors in the district. Their salaries are all paid by that federal grant we've been talking about. Miss Jordan grew up around here, and she says mental health services have long been hard to come by in rural and low-income areas like this.
Being able to access that in school in an environment they are comfortable with, they can now access their mental health and focus on academics.
And the service is free, which is huge because more than two-thirds of the people in this community struggle with poverty, and that comes with all kinds of challenges.
We're seeing a lot of anxiety, more depression. Parents may be struggling with substance use, maybe not having heat, kids living in campers.
Ms. Jordan says when her students get better at coping with their mental health, they do better in school and in all areas of life.
Early on this year, I was having a hard time with coming to school. I would be like exhausted, tired, angry.
That's Riley again.
But then I kind of actually really looked forward to going to Ms. Jordan's because I think that I'm less anxious and frustrated in class.
Ms. Jordan and her colleagues have a long wait list. They started serving students about 3 years ago when the district got its mental health grant from the federal government. The money was supposed to run out in 2027, and the district had a plan for that. But late last Wednesday, not long after I met Riley and Ms. Jordan, the Trump administration announced that it would cut their grant by this December. The morning after the announcement, I gave Ms. Jordan a call.
What was your sort of reaction when you heard this news?
I was disappointed, just devastated for the kids, honestly.
What went through my head was having a hard time understanding why anyone would cut mental health supports for kids.
That's superintendent of the Skowhegan Area School District, Jonathan Moody. In response to that very question he asked about why these grants have been cut, an education department spokesperson told NPR in a statement, quote, recipients use the funding to implement race-based actions like recruiting quotas in ways that have nothing to do with mental health. Yet Moody says the money his district got was only used for student mental health care. And he said these jobs, this service, it's too important to lose, so they'll have to find the money somewhere else.
And that could be anything from not having a field trip go to not hiring a position that you otherwise might have.
And in the meantime, they may have to cut down the number of students who can see counselors like Ms. Jordan. It was odd to think that just a couple days earlier, I was sitting down with Riley, asking her,
I wonder if tomorrow Ms. Jordan wasn't able to be here, what do you think would be lost?
If I don't have a way to express my feelings, like if I'm mad at school, I might accidentally take it out on someone at home. So I think that skill might be lost.
In Riley's case, she's off to middle school next year, which brings its own new anxieties.
I'm kind of worried for the counselor next year because I have to get used to her all over again. But for right now, I have Ms. Jordan.
At least for right now. Janaki Mehta, NPR News, Skowhegan, Maine.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Wait and watch. That's the Federal Reserve's plan for now as it tries to navigate an increasingly uncertain economic landscape. The central bank voted to hold interest rates steady for the time being, despite President Trump's repeated demands for lower rates. NPR's Scott Horsley is covering this, and he's in the studio. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Ari.
Fed policymakers said this afternoon that the economic outlook is increasingly murky. Why is that?
Well, this was the first time the Fed's rate-setting committee had gathered since President Trump ordered those worldwide tariffs last month. Remember, 10% taxes on nearly everything the U.S. imports, a whopping 145% tax on most goods coming from China. The central bank is worried if those tariffs stick, it raises the risk of rekindling inflation, dragging down economic growth. But even as the risk of that imported shoe dropping on the economy has gone up, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell says it's not absolutely certain it's really going to happen.
I don't think we can say which way this will shake out. I think there's a great deal of uncertainty where tariff policies are going to settle out, and also when they do settle out, what will be the implications for the economy, for growth, and for employment. I think it's too early to know that.
Powell acknowledged that there's any number of surveys out there showing people are really nervous about the trade war. They're afraid it's going to drive higher prices and a weaker job market. But until there's more clarity about what's really going to happen, Powell says it makes sense for the Fed to just stand pat.
Explain that, because if there's a danger of higher inflation or a spike in unemployment, why would they wait to adjust interest rates? Powell and his colleagues have been accused of being too slow to react in the past.
Well, Powell notes that right now the economy's actually in a pretty good place to be in a holding pattern. You know, inflation's a little higher than the central bank would like, but it's not that high. The unemployment rate's still quite low, just 4.2%. So Powell says it just doesn't feel like there's a lot of urgency to adjust interest rates right now.
We don't feel like we need to be in a hurry. We feel like it's appropriate to be patient. When things develop, of course, we have a record of we can move quickly when that's appropriate.
The other challenge, of course, is that, you know, if there's higher inflation, that would call for higher interest rates. If there's higher unemployment, that would call for lower interest rates. So it's hard to act before you know which of those problems might materialize. Or, worst case scenario, they both do, and then the Fed would have to make a judgment call about which problem to tackle most importantly.
This is all likely to make President Trump unhappy. He believes that Powell and his colleagues should have cut interest rates yesterday. So how does Trump's criticism affect the Fed's calculation, if it does at all?
Yeah, Trump has never been shy about browbeating the central bank, even though the Fed is supposed to be insulated from that kind of political pressure. Up until now, though, Powell and his colleagues have pretty much shrugged off that kibitzing from the White House.
Doesn't affect our doing our job at all. We're always going to do the same thing, which is we're going to use our tools to foster maximum employment and price stability for the benefit of the American people. We're always going to consider only the economic data, the outlook, the balance of risks, and that's it. That's all we're going to consider.
You know, Trump even threatened to fire Powell, but he's backed off that threat after a very chilly reception in the stock market. He will have a chance to appoint Powell's successor as Fed chairman about a year from now. But until then, Trump doesn't have a whole lot to say about what the central bank does.
NPR's Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
A group of U.S. vets and lawmakers is leading an effort to get clinical trials up and running for a potent psychoactive drug. Ibogaine is illegal in the U.S., but it's proving to be a powerful treatment for post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, and addiction. Jonathan Levinson has this report and a warning to listeners. This story includes references to suicidal ideation.
In June 2024, Clayton Smith made one stop on his way to killing himself. He went to Mexico for 10 days to do Ibogaine.
I knew that it wasn't going to work because I was so broken, and that when it inevitably didn't work, I could then kill myself knowing that I did everything possible.
He went because he thought his wife deserved answers about why his life had deteriorated so dramatically since he got back from a deployment to Afghanistan in 2012. A rocket-propelled grenade had detonated a few feet away from Smith, and the resulting traumatic brain injury led to hearing and short-term memory loss. He couldn't regulate his emotions, and his vocabulary was reduced to an eighth-grade level. Smith started drinking. He felt broken.
The depression and the anxiety and the self-loathing and, you know, the suicidal ideations, and it all just built and built and built.
When he finally came clean to his wife about his decade of lying and substance abuse, she kicked him out. The next day, he made plans to do Ibogaine. He was terrified. He thought he might get stuck in a dark alternate world forever.
And I was going to be being chased by my demons and all the flashbacks of the most awful things that have ever happened to me.
Instead, Smith spent 12 hours learning about himself for the first time. His mind was flooded with high-resolution images of formative moments in his childhood, like when he was 9 and a girl made fun of him for being chubby.
I got to watch the hurt in that boy's eyes. And at the same time, I was able to tell him, hey, man, like, it's all going to work out.
For Smith, the moment was pivotal.
Ibogaine allowed me to love myself for the first time in my life.
Ibogaine is a derivative of the West African Iboga plant. And starting in the 60s, it came to be known as a powerful tool in treating opiate addiction. But in recent years, when veterans started going to Mexico for Ibogaine to treat their PTSD and TBI, the drug got the attention of an unlikely set. Republican lawmakers. Proposed legislation in Texas would allocate $25 million to fund the first FDA-approved clinical trials in the country, potentially paving the way for Ibogaine to be authorized to treat opiate addiction and other mental health conditions.
Obviously, I'm not ever going to be for the legalization of drugs. That's off the table for me.
That's former Republican Texas Governor Rick Perry. After Perry's close friend and a former Navy SEAL recovered from an opiate addiction and PTSD through Ibogaine, Perry said he started to see psychedelics as more than recreational drugs. The treatment is often unpleasant. It can have serious side effects and requires medical supervision to take safely. But he says it is clearly miscategorized in the U.S. alongside drugs which are addictive and have no medical use.
I mean, how bad you gotta hate somebody to not make this compound available to them in the United States?
One leading theory for how Ibogaine works comes from a 2023 UC Berkeley study showing the drug opens a lengthy window of time when the brain is particularly open to learning new skills and behaviors.
Of all the psychedelics, Ibogaine seems to be unique in that it keeps this critical period open the longest.
Neuroscientist Gul Dolan led the study. She says MDMA or psilocybin opened that window for about 2 weeks. Ibogaine gives you a month or more. So Ibogaine helped Smith love himself for the first time, but that critical period is when his new belief system is solidified and old habits are discarded. For Smith, that was self-hate and alcohol. For others, it's opiates.
All of the circumstances where you might reach for heroin to alleviate that suffering have to be rewritten to say, okay, now I can be in this situation and not reach for that habit.
And the results seem to stick. It's not without work, but 10 months after his treatment, Clayton Smith says he feels better every day. He and his wife feel like they're in a good place.
It's given me the tool to be the person I've always wanted to be, and I hope this journey never stops.
Smith no longer looks back on the first 37 years of his life with resentment. And for the first time, he says he is excited for the next 37 years. For NPR News in San Francisco, I'm Jonathan Levinson.
And if you or someone you know might be considering suicide or is in crisis, contact the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline by dialing 988 or the Crisis Text Line by texting HOME to 741-741. Press 1 if you're a veteran.
This is NPR News.
The world is watching for those smoke signals that will indicate a new pope has been chosen. And we also turn to the rest of Europe for the anniversary of Victory Day, when the United Kingdom and its allies accepted Nazi Germany's unconditional surrender, marking the end of World War II. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. A new pope is on the horizon.
But what kind of faith leader could connect with a younger generation?
One of the reasons that Pope Francis connected with so many people is because he was authentic. And people say all the time that young people see right through pomp and circumstance.
We'll hear more after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump has switched up his pick for U.S. Surgeon General. He's now tapped Casey Means, a physician and author for the post, as NPR's Will Stone tells us.
Trump had previously picked Fox News contributor Dr. Jeanette Neshwat, but has now pivoted after questions emerged about her medical credentials. His new pick, Dr. Casey Means, gained popularity after publishing a bestseller on metabolic health. The co-author of her book is her brother, Callie Means, who's an advisor to Secretary of Health Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Casey Means attended Stanford Medical School and went on to train as a surgeon, but ultimately dropped out of her residency program before finishing it because of what she described as her frustrations with mainstream medicine. She went on to co-found the biotech and wellness company Levels, which offers continuous glucose monitoring devices to consumers. Will Stone, NPR News.
Here in Los Angeles, port officials say they are seeing a drastic reduction in shipments from China following President Trump's stiff 145% tariff on Chinese-made goods. Steve Futterman reports it's affecting workers and businesses.
At the Port of Los Angeles, the nation's largest port, officials are seeing the impact. Gene Soroka is the port's executive director.
The situation's not good. Cargo volume this week for imports is down 35% compared to last year. People are quite concerned, absolutely.
Charlie Camacho this week showed up at the Longshore Union's dispatch hall looking for work. He left empty-handed.
Less volume of cargo containers means less work for us.
Products that enter the U.S. at the Port of L.A. eventually wind up in stores in every state. The reduction in shipments here may soon be felt by consumers across the nation in both higher prices and, in some cases, empty shelves. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman at the Port of Los Angeles.
And you're listening to NPR. About 10,000 Afghans settled in the Houston area after their government fell to the Taliban in 2021. President Trump is now rapidly ending programs that allow them to stay here in the U.S. legally. From Houston Public Media, Andrew Snyder reports.
Many Afghans who settled in Houston after the fall of Kabul had spent years aiding U.S. and NATO forces in the war in Afghanistan. But immigration attorney Ali Zakaria says President Trump is determined to deport as many of them as he can.
What Trump administration's policy at this moment is to create this mass group that can be deported, and one way is to cancel the existing legal protocols or legal protections that are in place.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem has announced temporary protected status for Afghans will end May 20th. In a statement, DHS said Noem decided that TPS was no longer needed as the situation in Afghanistan had improved. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
The Fed left its key interest rate unchanged this afternoon, brushing off demands by President Trump to lower borrowing costs. Fed Chair Jerome Powell citing the rising risks of higher unemployment and higher inflation if Trump's tariffs on foreign-made goods are sustained. Powell says it will likely generate a slowdown in economic growth. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow, just outside Vatican City on the day the College of Cardinals begins the voting to choose a new pope. The question on everybody's minds, will that new pope continue the legacy of Pope Francis or reject some of the more surprising moves he took during his 12-year papacy? We have spent the week talking to Catholics with very different ideas about how the church should move forward. And today, I wanted to hear from the hosts of a podcast that over the years I have listened to follow news from the Vatican and the rest of the Catholic world. Ashley McKinless and Zach Davis host the podcast Jesuitical. It's put out by the Jesuit-affiliated America magazine. They're in Rome to cover the conclave. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Scott.
Thanks for having us.
Ashley, I'll start with you. The both of you, everybody from America magazine is cranking out podcasts and articles in this stretch. You're working very hard. I'm curious what your general impressions are of this moment for the church right now here in Rome.
Well, it is a huge historic moment, and you can tell that the entire world is interested just by the number of journalists here. But one thing that has struck me most is how seriously the cardinals take their responsibility in making this decision. You know, when you vote in a democracy, you know, it's your vote representing one person. Mm-hmm. This is 133 men representing over a billion Catholics worldwide. And I think they understand that who they choose matters to a lot of people. There was a rather epic thunderstorm in Rome.
Oh, yeah.
So that kept me awake. And as I was kind of tossing and turning in bed just a few hundred yards from the Vatican, I just had this image of 133 cardinals in a similar situation, just thinking about what they were going to have to do in the next couple of days.
A lot of media outlets, a lot of commentators are really framing, this is what's at stake in this conclave. These are the big questions in front of the Catholic Church. You both spend a lot of time thinking about this and reporting on this. What to each of you are the big stakes of this moment, the key forks in the road that the Catholic Church is thinking about?
You know, I think Pope Francis was a real reformer, and inevitably, whatever the outcome of this conclave is, it's going to be seen as a referendum on whether the Catholic Church wants to continue down on these reforms that Pope mm-hmm. Francis has started, because he really didn't finish a lot of the things he started. He was a pope who liked to launch balloons and see where they went. And he really left a lot of freedom up to his successor as to where they landed. So whoever's chosen, even what the pope is wearing when he comes out on that loggia that we're looking at, you know, Francis came out there in the simple white cassock. Mm-hmm. He chose to live not in the Apostolic Palace, but in the Casa Santa Marta, which was the Vatican guest house. I think a couple decisions really quickly are going to be interpreted by the rest of the world as, what does this new pope want to do?
And I think it matters for the world more broadly. When Pope Francis was elected in 2013, the church was in a real crisis. It was in a financial crisis. It was still reeling from the sexual abuse crisis. And so Pope Francis did have this mandate to reform the church, as Zach said. But he undertook those reforms not so that the church itself would be this pristine institution, but so that it could look outward to the world. And so if the church was in crisis in 2013, I think we can say the world is in crisis right now, and the papacy has this unique place on the world stage where it's a real moral authority. And I think without Pope Francis there, we've lost that. And whoever is chosen to be the next pope will have a lot on his plate when it comes to global diplomacy, wars in multiple countries, the rise of right-wing authoritarianism.
Shifting gears a little, you are both now older than you were when you started a podcast aimed at young Catholics. But especially in the world of religion, you're both very young. You're invested in the Catholic Church. You're both religious. That's, especially in the United States, that is a minority position for younger people. And I'm wondering if either of you have given thought, starting off with this, why you think that is, why you think so many people your age and younger have drifted away from organized religion and view themselves as secular or non-religious.
I think there's a lot of reasons for that as it relates to maybe who the Pope is going to be. I think one of the reasons that Pope Francis connected with so many people is because he was authentic, right? And people say all the time that young people see right through pomp and circumstance. And if you just look out here, there is a lot of pomp and circumstance here, right?
Yes.
I think it matters a great deal who this sort of figurehead, especially in the age of social media, like Pope Francis was infinitely memeable, right? So, and you could see that in the days after his death, that people were really reflecting on sort of the impressions that he left upon them.
On one hand, there's a lot of factors in 2025 to pull people away from the world of organized religion. On the other hand, there are a lot of indications that people in one way or another want belonging at this moment in time, and sometimes they're finding them in conspiracy theories. Sometimes they're finding it a whole wide range of different places. I'm curious if each of you think there's a few things that the Catholic Church can do to try to, obviously young people have different priorities all over the world, but let's just talk about the United States, let's talk about the Western Hemisphere, things that the church can do beyond who it selects next to try to appeal to younger people who are maybe on the verge of interested in this organization.
A couple things. One, I think a radical commitment to the poor and the marginalized, which was something that Francis sort of put at the center of his pontificate, something that Jesus put at the center of his ministry. I think people found that refreshing and exciting, and I think if the church continues to rediscover that within itself and promote that part of itself, I think that will do a great deal. I also think there's a lot of sort of structural changes that we could look at shaking up in the United States.
Whenever the church moves forward, it does so by looking back and drawing on the best of its tradition. And so when I think about attracting young people or just others who have fallen away from the faith, bringing them back, I think you got to focus on the basics. You know, the Mass is started as a meal. And so instead of us trying to come up with all this creative programming to attract the youth, make sure that that meal is as nourishing as possible. And I think, you know, literally having Mass with a meal, like, you know, Mass and then meal, because as you said, people are, they're bowling alone, they're dining alone. There's a lot of loneliness. And I think a Catholic church that can provide that sort of community that's not getting together for the sake of not being alone, but is centered on Jesus and the Eucharist, there is hunger for something like that.
I think a universal ban on smartphones would actually be wildly appealing to some people that feel tethered to them. So maybe
yes,
that's an option.
We can propose that to whoever emerges from this balcony in a few days. That is Zach Davis and Ashley McKinless, co-hosts of the America Magazine podcast, Jesuitical. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
And remember, once there is white smoke, NPR will have live special coverage as we learn the name of the new pontiff and see him emerge on that balcony for the first time to address the world. You can hear it on your radio, smart speaker, or online at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thousands of workers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have left their jobs since January as part of the Trump administration's effort to drastically reduce the government workforce. NPR's Ping Huang went to visit the CDC in Atlanta to see how it's handling the shifts of the past few months.
Every year, the CDC has a conference to celebrate the work of its disease detectives. It almost didn't happen this year. The Epidemic Intelligence Service training program was on a list of expected cuts in February, but then it was spared. Eric Pevsner, chief of the program, says they pulled the meeting together.
Yeah, we got late approval to have the conference given the change in administration. In something that would normally be planned over a period of about 6 months, they did in about 6 weeks.
The agency's disease detectives trained for 2 years before going off to serve as public health leaders across the country. The conference presentations are a rite of passage.
We've got over 80 scientific presentations, over 8 TED-style talks.
The program started more than 70 years ago and has trained more than 4,000 people. Many come back to the conference year after year. It usually feels like a big family reunion, but not this time. Dr. Ken Castro, a CDC alum now at Emory University, says people are anxious about the staffing and budget cuts.
What's their future going to be? It's uncertain. What are the people who we just finished training going to be doing? It's uncertain. So that is the challenge that we're all facing.
Around the conference, he sees a lot of empty chairs. Many people who would have been here got pushed out, and those remaining feel like they're being watched. Castro says that's why they canceled a satirical review, usually a conference highlight.
They feel too vulnerable to be making fun out of any figure of authority. That to me is part of the reign of terror that we're living under.
In an email requesting comment, an HHS spokesperson said the agency's restructuring is a necessary strategic effort to align with public health needs, reflecting responsibility and forward planning, not instability. The mood was livelier a few miles up the street by the main gates of CDC campus, where people were gathering to support the agency. Michael Beach worked behind those gates for decades.
I was a deputy director of the group that covers food, water, and fungal diseases. It was the most gratifying work that you can imagine, and you made a difference every single day.
Now he's retired, out here in a t-shirt and hiking boots, holding a sign that says, Save the CDC.
To cut the scientific staff to the bone, to close laboratories, cut off all of the data coming in about maternal health, about violence, about environmental health, those sorts of things are going to have a huge impact on the health of this country.
This weekly protest has been happening every Tuesday since February. But Mike Arnold, an advocate against vaccines, has been here for years. On a recent Friday, he's standing on the same corner by the CDC entrance by himself with his many signs. Some show his support for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the new health secretary.
Yes, he's a gift from God.
Others show his opposition to vaccines, claiming they cause autism, which is a view that has been debunked. Arnold says he feels mixed about the layoffs.
I don't like to see administrative people laid off, security people, that sort of thing, maintenance people. I feel sorry for them. The scientists and doctors, no, I don't feel a bit sorry for them.
Because of cuts to CDC programs for lead poisoning, asthma, disease detection, and yes, vaccines, public health experts warn that people will get sick or die. Ping Huang, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. There were some very persuasive people on Reddit recently who were not actually people. They were part of an experiment. Researchers at the University of Zurich wanted to see how persuasive AI could be. Problem is, the scientists did not get permission to do research on the actual humans on Reddit that the AI was interacting with. That's created a huge controversy about the ethics of the research. Reporter Tom Bartlett recently wrote about the experiment in The Atlantic. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how'd the experiment work?
So what the researchers did was they created comments in response to posts on a subreddit called Change My View. And Change My View is a place where people try to, as the name suggests, change each other's views. And they asked an AI to create comments in an attempt to change the view of whoever the poster was. And then they posted those comments on that subreddit. And they posted more than 1,000 comments over about 4 months.
And the questions ranged from whether pit bulls are more aggressive to whether living with your parents is a solution to the housing crisis. When the researchers finished this experiment, they were really eager to share their findings with the Reddit community. How did the community react?
They didn't react well. And I think to the researchers' surprise, according to the Reddit moderators who curate that subreddit, they were outraged. They felt as if they had been unwitting subjects in a scientific experiment, which they in fact were, and they felt as if a subreddit that they all take very seriously had been tainted by AI content.
People on the internet often lie about their identity. So what makes this different?
It's a good question. And I think some of those who have pushed back and said, well, maybe this isn't that big a deal. I think part of what makes this different is we're at a moment where, you know, we're sort of flooded with AI content in a bunch of different fora, and we're trying to deal with that. And in this, one of the things that really outraged people in this subreddit was not just they offered AI opinions that were computer generated, but that AI at various points was pretending to be, say, a black man who was against Black Lives Matter, or a city employee, or a trauma counselor. And I think that sort of impersonation and, you know, people not knowing that they were, you know, dealing with an AI rather than a real person, that really added to the sense of upset.
What did the researchers have to say in their defense?
Well, initially, I would say they were fairly defiant, and they offered an explanation and said that this was, they wrote in a preliminary paper that they published and then took down, that this was the best possible way to get honest reactions, that this, you know, getting something out, quote unquote, in the wild was the best way to evaluate whether AI could be persuasive and whether it could really fool people. And so they did that initially. They have since, due to the furor, have backtracked. And just yesterday, they issued an apology and said they would like to work with the subreddit to make sure this doesn't happen again. They promised not to do this again. They said they wouldn't publish their final results. And so they certainly heard the reaction and realized that it was not favorable.
You mentioned that they will not be publishing their results, but can you tell us more about what they found?
Right. So they in these preliminary results, they found that the AI responses were very persuasive. And they wrote that they were more persuasive than the vast majority of human comments. In this particular subreddit called Change My View, they actually keep track of how persuasive a comment is. So if something changes your mind, you mark that thing and you say, okay, that changed my mind. So these comments were very persuasive, and they also seemed to, as they wrote, blend seamlessly into the rest of the subreddit. So people didn't realize this was AI.
What are the larger implications here if AI truly is better than most humans at persuading real people to change their views?
Yeah, I think that's part of what makes this really interesting. I mean, this is important research that other researchers are doing in more traditional ways, where they're asking subjects to you know, examine whether they can tell if a particular comment is from AI and how persuasive it is. So this is an important area of research, and it's concerning if an AI can be persuasive on a particular topic and more persuasive than people. Could it be employed by bad actors to push whatever argument they're trying to push, and to have thousands of bots making this case? And so, you know, what these researchers are attempting to understand is, I think, a really important phenomenon. It's just, you know, we don't know whether this is going on in a bunch of different areas. And so we know in this case, because the researchers after the fact revealed that they had done this. But if they hadn't revealed, I don't think any of us would know.
Tom Bartlett's piece for The Atlantic is headlined, "The Worst Internet Research Ethics Violation I Have Ever Seen." Thank you for talking with us.
Thanks, Ari.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
About 60% of the Earth's surface is covered by the deep ocean, waters too deep for sunlight to penetrate. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports that scientists have now calculated exactly how much of the deep seafloor has ever been seen by humans.
Sonar can map the shape of the deep seafloor, but to actually see what's going on down there in the dark and the cold, to see the blobfish and the vampire squid and the ghost sharks, you need some kind of probe with lights and a camera.
When you're down there with a remotely operated vehicle or other sort of deep submergence vehicle, you can only see a very tiny bit of the deep seafloor at any one time.
Katie Croft Bell leads a nonprofit called Ocean Discovery League. She's also been exploring the deep sea for about a quarter century.
But it wasn't until about 4 or 5 years ago that I thought to myself, well, how much have we actually seen?
So she and some colleagues contacted every oceanographic institution around the world to pull together a massive database of deep sea expeditions since 1958. And what they found after adding up all the observations is that the area seen by people is only a tiny fraction of the deep sea floor.
It ends up being an area of less than the size of Rhode Island.
In the journal Science Advances, they say 99.999% of the deep seafloor remains unseen. And most of the area that has been explored is within 200 nautical miles of the United States, Japan, and New Zealand. So it's not a diverse sample. She says we don't know what habitats are down there that we've never discovered. And even though the deep ocean might be out of sight, out of mind for most people, the currents down there are bringing oxygen and nutrients up towards the surface.
You know, all of these things are connected and impact us in so many different ways.
John Copley is a deep sea expert with the University of Southampton in the United Kingdom, who wasn't part of the research team. He says he's not surprised by this, but it's good to have some real numbers.
I think what this paper highlights is, you know, there's still a need for a systematic global approach to deep ocean exploration.
He thinks the future will be low-cost technologies that let more communities around the world try to see what's down there on the deep ocean floor. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from RBC Wealth Management, where financial advisors work to understand individual goals and are dedicated to providing customized advice to help strengthen financial security. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and...